Access number 29065, Mr. Michael White, Reel 10. Now, we go back into sort of the various incidents that happened. On November 17th, there was a lot of Chinese artillery fire. Can you tell us about that? What do you remember about that now?
Yes, I remember going to the top of the hill, top of our hill, I suppose it was, or one of the humps sort of thing, things like that. And the Chinese, they were pounding the next hill the side of us, which I think at that time was the King Shropshire Light Infantry and things like that. And I do remember kind of that part there. It was one big mass of smoke and explosions and things like that. And I actually wondered really how kind of anyone could actually really survive that kind of, you know, that part and things like that. And it was only later on that I was actually told that kind of say there was only one or two had actually been killed, and because they were kind of quite deeply dug in. But I was actually told that one or two of the Ford platoons had actually been overrun.
Now, what about during that day? You were also firing at missions, and you had some incoming shell fire on your rear on the battery headquarters.
Oh yes, there was a lot of activity at that time and things like that. And of course, kind of being on the 4.2 mortars, we were on kind of either a dip or on the rear slopes of kind of the hills and things like that. So lots of the actual the artillery field guns, their rounds would actually go over the top of us sort of thing, and the ones which would actually catch us would actually be mortars similar to ourselves. But on that day, I do remember kind of our battery headquarters, which was kind of to the rear of us, and I think I understand there were about five or more actually wounded because of this activity.
Then the weather started to break. Can you tell us how the weather broke?
Well, this was kind of say the kind of like the coming up to say like the November period sort of thing. It was kind of the early part of kind of like the Korean winter as such, and this was a period when it's kind of like it was mostly lots of rain and that, and of course all the actual the roads as such became very muddy, and there were lots of problems with kind of getting kind of like the ammunition and especially the water through to us because of the I think the water trucks used to be these Bedford 1500 weight water trucks, and they was only kind of rear wheel drive as such, and so quite often they couldn't make it. So when the water used to come through, it used to be kind of on the with a Bedford four wheel drive truck, and they used to tow kind of like a water trailer behind and things like that. And even when it kind of even got as worse as that sort of thing, we used to have to send a jeep out with kind of some these 5 gallon jerry cans for our water.
And what about, I mean, drainage? I mean, were you subject to, was there any water coming into your dugouts or into your trench? You know,
no, because we was on, say, like the rear slopes of kind of hills, our actually dugouts, we was about maybe about 5 or 6 feet deep on the hillside, but at the front we used to have to build up with sandbags. And then, of course, when the water used to start running down kind of like the hills and things like that, we used to kind of dig kind of like a little bit of a trenchy gully thing. Hopefully kind of the water would actually drain away. But that period, we used to have an old tarpaulin, as we thought, over the top sort of thing to keep the water out sort of thing. But I mean, that eventually we learned later that these old tarpaulins were our tents.
Now, it also snowed on, I think, the night of the 22nd of November. How bad was it when it snowed? I mean, actually,
well, the winter was beginning to start, and it gradually moved from mostly kind of from rain. And I mean, so some days, I mean, the weather was quite good. And also in that period of kind of the November, this is when we used to get the fog used to come down about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, when usually most of all the problems started off, and all the bangs and crashes and rattles from the machine guns used to start up. And but it didn't really, it used to get kind of little bits of snow, but it didn't really start snowing until more or less about the Christmas period. This is when, as I remember, the snow started, and this is when kind of like it did start getting kind of very muddy and wet to the feet.
I mean, would you actually get standing snow, you know, 2 or 3 inches of snow on the ground, or would it just turn into mud?
The winter of 1951 was not as severe as the first winter, the 1950s. That's when it was a really bad winter, when they had lots and lots of snow, especially in where they were moving up in, especially in the northern part of Korea and things like that. But as I actually remember, the real bad snow, although we had bits and pieces, we didn't really get a lot of what I call nasty snow till I think it was about February, when there was a period when we actually moved out of the line for a couple of weeks.
On the 25th, the Chinese made a big attack on Hill 355. They got it, it was captured back, the rest of it. Were you very aware of this fighting going on? It wasn't that far away from your Hill 355, it was just on your right, I believe.
Oh, yes. I mean, the fighting, the bangers and crashing was going on every night, sort of thing. And as I remember, kind of from all my memories, sort of thing, the only day, or in fact 2 days, when we did not fire a single round was Christmas Day and the Chinese New Year's Day, sort of thing, things like that. So the whether that was kind of like a gentleman's agreement between us and the Chinese, I mean, it was jokingly, I mean, it's, I don't know. But even then, kind of even on Christmas Day, that the 25 pounders behind us, they were firing on what we call this Harrison fire, where they kind of fire these shells at certain spots where the actual Chinese use for patrolling, or kind of gaps through the hills where they're likely to attack and things like that.
But in a way, that's the reverse of the question I asked you, because I was asking about the attack on the 25th of November. It's the big attack on Hill 355.
Oh, yeah. Now, we at that time, because we're talking about kind of November, and we hadn't been out there. We'd only been out there just a matter of weeks. And kind of like, we was on Hill 187, and kind of just to our right was the major hill, kind of the highest point. It was Hill 355, and these, I think, they're based in metres. And this was the highest point, and of course the theory was that if Hill 355 was actually lost, then the Chinese spotters or artillery spotters could go on the top, sort of thing, and then they can see, and the whole line would have to move back, sort of thing. So it would be a tragedy to lose Hill 355. And I think at that period, more or less kind of from memory, that kind of like the infantry battalions and that were often chopping and changing and things like that. And I think the Commonwealth Division, I think it slightly moved to the left. And I think the Americans took over part of Hill 355. I can't remember which unit it was. And of course, it was actually attacked. And the Americans actually lost it, but it was then retaken, I think, very early the next day. And of course, with our 4.2 mortar sort of thing, we could just about reach it, and we had to more or less have the not horizontal but right low. And of course, when you actually fire, I think we can actually fire nearly about 4,000 yards, I think, at the maximum. And they used to have put the bombs in the top and hold it, and the gunner used to have to thump it down so it went down, so it went slowly down to the barrel till it went off. But it was quickly retaken, because it was a serious situation, that kind of, if you lost Hill 355, and there'd been lots and lots of battles all over, especially on the early slopes, and lots of the infantry battalions were actually involved in these things.
Now, just another step, there were sort of farm buildings and villages behind the lines. Can you talk a bit about that? Were they occupied or not?
What?
Korean, obviously.
Where the actual line was during most of the period that I was actually in Korea, there was no real civilians as such. All the civilians had been removed to the rear, sort of thing. And so they were these isolated kind of like farm buildings. They wouldn't be villages and things like that. And just to the bottom of our position, because at that time we had barbed wire all the way around us, and down in the bottom of the kind of the dip from Hill 187, there were some of these actually farm buildings, and there used to be a stream running along the bottom. And I remember kind of say on quieter moments, sort of thing, sometimes we used to kind of go out there. We used to have to collect, in those early days, our fires were from firewood. They were not from petrol or diesel and things like that. And so we used to have to go and kind of collect this kind of firewood to heat the dugouts. And also down in these buildings, and they were still they hadn't been destroyed in any way. There were some very deep bunkers with these, actually, these little hamlets and things like that. But when you actually went in them, they had these slide, like the Japanese sliding doors, because I suppose it was part of the Japanese occupation and things like that. And they had this marvellous underfloor heating, because, you know, with the bitter cold winters, and it appears they used to dig kind of like a tunnel underneath the rooms and that, and then used to kind of have this heat, these fires at part, and it used to, all the heat used to go underneath, and it used to heat all the floors. But also, as I remember in those days, there used to be these huge, great big terracotta pots and things like that in these outbuildings, and also in, like, the, I suppose, what class of the kitchen. And of course, there was no one about, and of course, in our position sort of thing, there was ammunition everywhere. There was all these tracer bullets and things anywhere like that. So quite often we used to take our rifles down there and we used to kind of have some practices and kind of used to get these big pots sort of thing. We used to fire the rifles from the hip, because in training, or in the whole of the period of kind of being in the army, I can never, ever remember firing a rifle either standing up or kneeling down and things like that. And that was the very first time we did it. Normally, when you fired a rifle in training, you was always landing on the ground and in the prone position.
Now,
what we actually did there, we kind of we just used to practice these things. It was just a thing, just to get away from that kind of there, just for a half an hour or so, just for a break.
You have a story of how you nearly shot down one of your own aircraft. Can you tell us that?
Oh, yes, but we with an actual mortar sort of thing. I mean, the mortar is kind of like, it is more or less a vertical thing. The actual idea really is to be behind a hill and just kind of lob a bomb over the hill to the slopes to the other side and things like that. And so we was constantly on these targets, and sometimes you used to get these airstrikes used to come over. And kind of, they used to come over the radio sort of thing. I think it was kind of the word used to come over, Plan George, Plan George, Plan George. And it used to give a map reference, like Mike Roger, 126, 154. And then you'd see these planes would be up in the sky. The spotter plane would be zooming around the valleys and that. And then these maybe about four planes from the aircraft carriers, which were usually either an Australian carrier or the British carriers on our side. And about these four planes, then they'd just peel off one by one like the Stukas of World War II, and then they'd drop the bomb sort of thing. But you see, when we was also gave these airstrikes, we were also perhaps firing on targets at the same time, and it came through that we nearly shot down one of our planes and things like that. And then after that, there was kind of the orders came from above, for want of better words, and the orders were that we were not to fire any targets when there was an airstrike in operation, when once we heard this thing of Plan George, Plan George, Plan George.
Now, can I ask you about the food? We did the conditions earlier, but I didn't talk about the food at the time. What sort of food were you getting?
Well, as you appreciate, kind of like more or less when we left England sort of thing, or even the period when we was in Korea, there was still certain amounts of kind of rationing on the go. And of course, when we got to Hong Kong, the food improved tremendously and things like that. And when we got to actually Korea, instead of being on this kind of this, what I call these army rations of perhaps World War II type things with bully beefs and tin bits and pieces, things like that, we was more or less kind of, we were fed mostly on American rations. And of course, in our actual camp, we had one Army Catering Corps cook. He was a corporal in the Army Catering Corps, and one of our gunners used to actually help him. And this is my first really experience of anything about cooking. And he actually built one of these stoves. They never had one of these gas things like the infantry used to have, where they used to have these, because they were feeding masses of people. He was just feeding about 30 odd gunners and that. So what he actually did, he got one of these 40 gallon drums, and it was actually cut down, and they kind of they made a big hole in the side of the hill, which was part of his so-called cookhouse. And he used to cook all this food, actually, or a lot of it actually, in this 40 gallon drum. And quite often we used to have things, say, like big pieces of steak, and there used to be like chicken and turkeys and things like that. This was not all the time. And there used to be things, and also we used to have what we call the American C7 rations. Now, these, So these were the small brown tins, I actually remember, and they used to come in kind of like packs of about 12 tins, if I remember rightly. And they used to be kind of they used to be pork and beans, they used to be spaghetti and all these goodies, which was marvellous, really. And also there used to be like a tin where you cut it open sort of thing, and there used to be all these kind of like cookies, you know, American biscuits. And then there used to be kind of like toilet paper in there, and there used to be have this cigarettes and things like that. Of course, I didn't smoke in those days, and so quite often when we was kind of like a problem, say like with food, and that we used to kind of used to gather these tins of beans, and we used to take them in our own dugout sort of thing, and with our army jackknife, we used to kind of stamp a big hole in the top and put it on top of the stove, and then kind of cut it open with a jackknife, and we used to eat it with a spoon out of there. And it was quite. Some of this food was quite rich, really, to the taste of the British soldier, who's kind of been used to kind of like the English style of foods and things like that. And sometimes, after a while, some of the actual soldiers, you know, they got a bit fed up with it. They would prefer something like the old English steak and kidney pie.
What would you get with the American? What kind of thing were in these tins?
Well, it was, like I say, it was like, used to be kind of this rich tin of beans with pieces of pork in there, and this spaghetti, and they were all different types and things like that, and I used to enjoy it, I did. And that,
but some found it a bit too rich.
Yeah, some did, but in those early days, it was, you know, coming from kind of a ration country like Britain sort of thing, I mean, it was like a Christmas, it was.
What would you eat? Do you use your mess tins?
Well, what we used to have two mess tins and that, and sometimes, because by this period now, because as kind of the days went on, and kind of like you were living in this awful condition sort of thing, lots of things got lost. So where you actually started off with what we call the eating irons, which was a knife, fork and spoon, things kind of got lost and things like that. So after a while, people would just eat him just purely with a spoon and things like that, and used to have like a little tin mug more or less for your tea, and of course quite often they got lost and that, and so used to go up and used to have this thing plonked in there. And but one of the things where I can't ever remember having, I can't ever remember my whole period in Korea was having any bread, although I understand that they were people used to make bread, but I suppose perhaps in the positions we were, we never had bread. But they used to make the tea in a bucket. This was amazed me, really. They used to have a bucket, and they used to kind of put so many handfuls of tea actually in the bucket, and used to cut the boiling water in it and things like that. And then used to get these, in those days, used to have these tins of condensed milk, and used to kind of punch at the top and just pour the thing, and they just stir it up, and then people just used to either dip the mug in or the things like that. But it was very welcome. We used to have tea on and off, you know, through different periods of the, especially through the night period and things like that, the cook used to do. And he was very, very good, he was, that cook, in those awful conditions he was actually operating, not only because it was in the open air, it was not covered over and things like that. It was, you know, with the kind of the rain and the drizzles and especially when the snow started coming and that. All credit to our cook.
And another aspect of condition, what about washing? Were there showers or anything? How did you get clean, or were you able to keep clean?
Washing? There was, you had the choice in those early days, because especially as the winter started coming, people didn't really remove their clothing. I mean, they started off, you used to have a string vest on, and then an ordinary vest, and then a shirt, and then used to be the little pullover, and then the big pullover, then the anorak thing, and then perhaps you'd have your big parka on. And so with all this moving about, especially when you was unloading ammunition and doing, and especially digging, I mean, you had to take a lot of clothes off when you was digging, but you see, when you was actually sweating and things like that, and so this so-called underclothes, which was say like the pair of the pants sort of thing in the warmer period, and until it kind of came to the winter period when you started wearing these, what we call these three-quarter pants with a slit at the front and the back for toilet usage, or even say the long johns, which went more or less right down the old, like, I never did ever wear those because I always referred to my old grandfather, but I did wear the actual, what we call the John L. Sullivans, after the box of old, where these boxers used to square up to each other, but I did wear those. And but you see, all this with all the sweat and things like that, you then kind of develop where kind of no air was getting to your actually body. And so this is the period when all the lice started. And so when it actually came to kind of washing underwear as such, people said, and then kind of then the Korean laborers used to actually, they used to wash them, they used to give them a kind of handful of cigarettes, you know, for doing it and things like that, because we had hundreds of packs of American cigarettes was everywhere and that. But you see, the only other time then you could actually go down to that
now,
actual...
On, tell me about the lice problem. Before we'll go on to when you went back to the showers and things. What about the lice? How big a problem were...
Well, like I say that...
Because you seem to have reacted in quite a common manner, but obviously yeah. to you, you didn't know. Tell me how you reacted when you first found
well,
lice.
Well, I mean, the actual lice, as I actually remember, that my first sighting really was kind of when I actually came to kind of change my kind of underwear. It was actually in the, when I used to go in the dugout and change them off and things like that. And I saw all these rows of white eggs all down the seams of kind of like the pants and the vests and things like that. And of course, I was quite horrified really, because I mean, to me, it was embarrassing really. And that, and so, I mean, I was so embarrassed, and rather than kind of wash them sort of thing, I just chucked them we used to have a little rubbish dump where we used to kind of burn the stuff and things like that. So I chucked those away and just put others on and that. But then afterwards, I mean, it seemed that kind of nearly everyone got it, because she was actually, I think sometimes when you went into some of these Korean buildings, you know, like these so-called farm buildings or hamlets, because the Koreans were in there, I mean, this is where you could actually catch the lice and things like that. But I think a lot of it was due really because you never change your clothes, because all that you had, all this massive clothing on, and the heat just built up in there, and I suppose it was the body odors and things like that. And like I say, I do remember kind of like one fella, he was a sergeant, a marvellous fella really, he was quite a hardy fella, and he went down to the bottom of this stream, just the other side of the barbed wire and things like that, and he got one of these cut down 40 gallon oil drums, and he filled it full of water, and he built a fire underneath, and so it's burning things like that, and he actually got in this tub and things like that. I mean, this was a period when it was bitterly cold. Then afterwards, he just bored his pants and his vest and his bits and pieces and things like that. But then afterwards, after we'd been in the in the front line, you know, for a while sort of thing, we used to go down to some shower unit. It was somewhere down in the rear. I've got no idea where it was, whether it was an American or whether it was British and things like that. And we used to go down in twos and threes. And so when you got down there, I actually remember that kind of that this row of these showers, and of course I think it was in a tent situation, it was freezing cold outside, and I remember we were going in there, and these hot showers, it was so hot and it was lovely, and I didn't really want to leave them. And of course when we actually came out of it, they just took all our old underwear, and they just, I suppose it was burnt, and then they just gave us all fresh new underwear. And of course when we used to kind of come back in the truck to our little encampment as such, for want of better words, and of course there used to be this standing joke that kind of we used to go out there turning, you know, looking brown and coming back white. And of course in those days there was all these racial comments about coming back looking white instead of brown and that. But basically I can't ever. I can only really remember going about either once or twice to a shower unit the whole period I was there, until I actually went on leave to the camp at Incheon, or when I went on R&R to Tokyo.
Now, the next thing is sort of, well, is actually Christmas. Now we've discussed the sense that you didn't fire on Christmas Day. Now, what about were there any sort of celebrations? What was Christmas Day for you?
Well, Christmas 1951, it was the first time I'd ever been away from home at Christmas. And so it was something different. And of course, I think there was always that tradition in the army that kind of Christmas time, the officers and the senior NCOs, they would actually serve the men. This is when they're actually, I'm talking about in barracks and things like that. Now, we was actually out in the open as such. But just prior to Christmas, a sergeant major who was I wouldn't say a tyrant in Hong Kong. People used to kind of avoid him if possible, like all sergeant majors and officers. But he was marvellous actually in Korea and that. And he used to take some of our rum ration. And of course, where the ordinary squad is, they just got a ration of beer. But with the senior NCOs, they got a ration of spirits, like whiskey or gin or whatever they wanted and that. And so he took. I think the officers gave him some of their. Some of their spirit, bottles of spirit, and of course with some of our rum ration, he just went out on a scavenging trip with his jeep round the American bases, and of course the Americans had got everything and things like that. So he then acquired all this, he acquired all these boards and like planks and things like that, and also all these foods, I think, I don't know, nuts and all things like that. So when we actually came back for the very first time, they built these like a bench type tables as such, and so when we had actually a Christmas thing, I mean our cookie was marvellous really, with all this we had this turkey and all these goodies associated with the American rations and that, and also kind of we had the rum ration, and also we had some bottles of beer and things like that, and we did not fire a single round on that day. And I do remember.
He started again next day.
He did start sprinkling of snow on that Christmas day and that, and so that it was something kind of special for. But after Christmas Day, those actually bench tables or whatever they were, they just disappeared, and we just went back to normal. So if you wanted any food, you just went up to the cook sort of thing, and he just ladled it out of his pots and pans and things like that. I do believe that kind of the infantry soldiers, kind of when they went out in reserve, I mean, they had proper Christmases and things like that where it was all set up. They were living in tents and that. But we was on the mortars, and we never really went out in reserve.
You seem to have done quite a bit of firing on December the 30th and New Year's Eve. Do you remember that?
Yes, when it came up to New Year's Eve, and I'm talking about the British New Year's Eve, you know, the January of the 1st one, not the Chinese one. And of course, we expected what we called an Agra Target, which is an abbreviation for Army Group Royal Artillery, when all the guns all along the line would actually fire. But for some reason or other, it didn't. I remember the kind of some very lights went up and things like that. And I think we only fired about 50 odd bombs, if I remember from my memory.
So it was a bit of a... Now, what about your first
But I do remember, I think, at that period, it did begin to snow around that period.
What about your first casualty? It was a driver.
I think that was in the early part of the 52. I think it must have been about January. I'm not quite certain now. But there was one of these big bangs that kind of went up. This was in one of the lull periods, you know, when I suppose it was perhaps maybe a harassing fire from the Chinese or a ranging shot. There was this bang, and all of a sudden someone yelled out that, I forget what his name is now, but so-and-so, he's been hit. And of course, I mean, we was only a small group of about 30 odd gunners. And of course, I remember kind of going over to him, and he was laying down. He was in the centre of our encampment, of all places. He was what should have happened there. And anyway, he was just lying on the floor. And I remember we turned him over, and there was just this small hole in the back of his back, and that. And like I say, we had to we actually covered him over with a ground sheet, I remember. And then later on, I think a truck or something came from battery headquarters, and they took him away. But that was as I remember, that was the very first time I'd ever touched a dead person since my grandfather. Because when I was 13 years old, my grandfather died, and I can't remember if it was my mother or my father insisted that I actually touched him on the forehead, and of course he was cold, and that was so this fellow was the very first person I'd touched. Since my grandfather died and things like that, and he was our very first casualty we had.
Did he upset you? I mean, how did you react? It must have brought it home to you a bit.
No, I found with kind of like when I saw these dead bodies, you know, in the future sort of thing, I had no immediate. It was more or less like a curiosity feeling, really, unless it was someone like a friend who I actually knew personally and things like that. It was, say, like a family member. Then I actually would actually feel it. But anyone, it was just, say, like a body as such as that, and because it was a new experience for me.